Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, it's time to get real.
Oh, yeah.
It's a new experience.
Reality, spirituality.
Yeah, keep your ears open for this one, man.
Reality, spirituality.
You got a question for RLM?
Reality, spirituality.
Yeah, it's time to get some answers, baby.
Reality, spirituality.
Oh, now we get real.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Reality Spirituality. I am Global Happiness Specialist and Inner Peace Practitioner, Rebecca L. Norrington. Thank you for listening to the show. Thank you for sharing the show. The show is growing organically. I don't know how, but I really appreciate everyone sharing. And today, usually, and I know I have been off for a couple of weeks. I've been traveling. However, today I am so excited to have a guest on Reality Spirituality. But before I do, let me just describe for the new listeners what this show is about. Woo. When I say happiness specialist, when Reality Spirituality is about how to experience more happiness in your life. And I also share with you the definition of happiness, which is my definition, which is the ability to be at peace regardless of what happens and regardless of what doesn't happen, and how to be happy regardless of what happens to you, and why happiness is so important. And when I say happiness, I'm talking about is an inner peace, a foundational contentment, a balance, a vibration of peace. So happiness, peace, contentment, all those words are interchangeable to me. The other thing that I share on the show is how to avoid behaviors that subtract from your happiness. And happiness is a practice skill, just like any other skill: writing, speaking, gardening, chef, an athlete. It is a practice skill, and the more you practice, guess what? Like any other skill, the better you get at it. So when I say happiness is a practice skill, and it is a daily practice, the question that you ask yourself is, are you ready to prioritize happiness over anything else? And again, I'm going to use happiness and inner peace interchangeably. The first part of the practice starts with gradually eliminating those behaviors that have been proven to subtract from happiness. Example, having expectations, blaming someone or circumstances for how you feel, comparing yourselves to others, the inability to change a belief or a perspective, worrying, you can't be at peace and you're worrying at the same time, lack of acceptance of others, believing words have power, noticing what someone else is doing. That'll all, when I stick my nose in anybody else's business, trust me, unhappiness is right around the corner. Being impatient. The second part of the practice is cultivating behaviors that have been established to add to happiness, meaning acceptance of self, trust that everything that's happening is happening for a reason. Maybe if I can't see it in the moment, but there's evidence in my life, there's evidence in your life that going through any kind of traumatic or any kind of circumstance where we wouldn't have wanted to, but if you look back, you can really find out how that benefited you. Maybe not in the moment, but all experiences have the opportunity, give you the opportunity to grow, give you the opportunity to expand, having more self-awareness, being yourself, and letting go of trying to control anything or anyone outside of yourself, and being okay with uncertainty. That's a really big practice, being okay with uncertainty. That's a hard one, but I promise you that the behaviors that add to happiness when practiced on a daily basis, and it is a daily practice, that you will experience more peace and more contentment. Oh, boy, oh boy, am I excited. I'm excited to share with you my guest, and let me just give an introduction. Linda Sunshine West, don't you love that middle name? The queen of collaboration, speaker, international number one best-selling author, executive film producer of Wishman, red carpet interviewer, philanthropist, founder of Women Action Takers, Linda Sunshine West ran away from home at 5 years old and was gone for an entire week. She came home with her head bent down, riddled with fear, and wouldn't look people in the eyes for decades to come. At the age of 51, she decided to stop letting fear rule her life and went on a journey of facing one fear every day for a year, 365 days in a row. In doing so, she gained an exorbitant amount of confidence and developed her simple 7-step process to help others break through fear. Now, I don't remember exactly how I found her, but I was listening to an interview she was doing, and when she said that she tackled a fear, one fear a day for a year, I was already hooked. I find it so rare to meet someone that is actively, and one thing, she's an action taker, to actively do something about changing your life or do something about expanding as opposed to not doing, and with not doing anything. And I was really drawn by her. I was drawn by her energy. I was drawn by her spirit. And she is the perfect guest to share with us, my reality, spirituality audience, how, why, and just secrets to fighting through the fear, because we all have it. You know, we were born with two fears. I mean, innate fears, the fear of loud noises and the fear of falling. And all these other fears are programmed. So I'm really excited to welcome Linda Sunshine West to Reality Spirituality. Thank you so much, Linda. Welcome to the show. Hello.
Hi, Rebecca. It's so great to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to see what we dive into today.
Yes, yes. You know, when I heard you talking about, let me ask you this question. Do you know anyone personally that, I mean, that is such a big deal to tackle a fear, one fear a day for a year. How did you even decide to do that? What was the driving motivation?
Question. Yeah, thanks for asking that question. In 2014, this all started in 2014 when one day I was driving to work. I was in the corporate world for 36 years. I was working my 49th job, working for a judge in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And I just had this thought of like, oh, my God, this is awful. I hate what I do. I hate traffic. I was so filled with hate. And as I was driving to work, I was saying, oh, my gosh, I have no purpose for being here. There's no reason for me to be on this planet. All I do is push papers around for a judge. And, you know, and I was like, what is the purpose of the planet? What is my purpose? I just didn't understand. I asked those questions, and I had no answers. But then when I got to work that day, there was a Facebook post inside of a group from some woman I didn't know, and it said, I'm a life coach. I took some time off. I'm getting back into it. I'm looking for 5 women who want to change their life. And I had been asking myself a question about what's my purpose, and I said, I don't know what a life coach is, but I'm in. You know, I want to change my life. And so I dove in and worked with her for 5 months, and that was in 2014. And I worked with her until November. And at the end of November, I decided to quit that job to embark on a journey called entrepreneurship. I had no idea what I was going to do, how I was going to make any money, or who I was going to work with, but I knew what I didn't want to do anymore, and that was drive every day to a job that I hated. So in December,
I was going to say, and talking about diving into uncertainty, keep going. That's very powerful. Keep going.
Yeah. So December, I had worked with my life coach until November. I quit my job. Now I'm December, and I'm by myself. I have no idea how I'm going to make any money or anything. I had no life coach, and I got addicted to the positive change that happened in my life that 5 months working with her. So December, I'm by myself, and I still made changes, but not nearly as much as I had. And January 1st, 2015, I woke up that morning, and I said to myself, like, I got so addicted to that change and that positivity, and I want to keep it going. Oh, my gosh, I have so many fears. I'm going to break through a fear every day this year. It was a commitment I made, not a New Year's resolution, because I don't know about you, but I have broken every New Year's resolution I have ever made in my life. And so
of
I knew it wasn't going to be
too.
A resolution.
Yeah.
I think most of us do, right? And so it was a New Year commitment that I made. And so every morning, the very first thing I would do before I got out of bed is ask myself one simple question. So these three words changed my life. And the question was, what scares me? And then I would lay in bed, and I would wait until the first fear popped into my head. Sometimes it was instant, and sometimes, you know, it was 10, 15 minutes, but I laid there and waited. And then whatever that first fear was that popped up, that was the commitment that I had to break through that fear that day. And I did it 365 days in a row.
Can you give us three of those fears a short story? Just because I'm curious, I heard one about the Starbucks, but I would like maybe three fears to share with the audience, please.
Yes, of course. Oh, I'm going to share the Starbucks because your audience hasn't heard it, because this to me was the funniest and really random one. That morning, I asked myself a question, what scares me? And it was very specific, to speak to a stranger in a Starbucks. And you know, I had been going to Starbucks to work because I wanted to get out of the house to work. So I'd go to Starbucks and I'd, you know, set up my laptop. And so that day I showed up at Starbucks and I waited for a stranger to talk to because everybody was paired up. And the fear was a stranger, not a group of strangers. So it had to be a singular person. I'm very literal like that. And so I saw this one man walk in, and I was like, oh, my God, there he is, my victim. You know, I get to go talk to this person and break through that fear. And so he sat down, and I walked over to him, and I said, excuse me, sir, I'm facing a fear every day, and my fear today is to talk to a stranger in Starbucks. And I said, do you mind if I have a seat? And he's like, okay. So I sat down with him, talked to him for about 5 minutes, got up, thanked him for his time, walked out, and just like I felt like throwing up, but I didn't. And I broke through that fear. Now, that fear might not seem like a big deal to a lot of people, but to me it was. So that was one of them. That was the one that stood out the most to me just because it was very random. But one thing I did discover during that year is that the vast, vast majority of my fears were the fear of judgment. So some of the fears would be just going to a networking event and, again, approaching somebody. What I discovered also about myself is that I'm an extrovert. I love being in environments with a lot of people, but I'm very shy to approach people. So that was one of the biggest ones is, you know, talking to a stranger here, talking to a stranger there. Maybe it was at the grocery store. Actually look at the person who's, you know, ringing up my order and say thank you. That was one of my fears. Something so simple to a lot of people, but not simple to everybody. And so these fears of just, you know, as you mentioned in my bio, I had my head bent down and didn't look people in the eyes for decades to come. That was because I had such fear of actually seeing people and looking at them in the eyes. And so that was a lot of my fears were related to just having a conversation, starting a conversation, going to a networking event, paying some money to attend something, you know. So There were a lot of different fears, but the majority of them centered around the fear of judgment. And there's a saying, saying that more people are scared of speaking on stage than they are of dying. This is a very common saying that I hear in the speaker world. The reality, and I call BS on that, because the reality is that people are scared of the judgment from speaking on stage. They're not scared of speaking on the stage. It's the judgment that they may receive from speaking on stage.
Wow. You know, and I also want to say, because you said so many important things, one of the things is we're all so different. I say we are as different as our fingerprints. And what is, just like you said, what is terrifying for one is not for another. The thing about, one of the things I always talk about is the reason why people get embarrassed is because they care about what someone else thinks. And it really comes back to acceptance of self. And when you really accept yourself, that embarrassment gene just goes away. It's a total acceptance of self. And when you talked about looking at people in their eyes, and then also people would look at you. So I get that judgment thing. And what I talk about is that judgment, even judging people, is a programming, meaning that we weren't born judging anyone. We were taught to judge. We were taught to blame. We were taught to, it was something that we were programmed to believe, that judgment is good. Is good. And it always starts with judgment of self. At least that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, well, definitely.
Any comment
one thing
to that?
I realized. Yeah, thing I realized during that year is that I was very judgmental. So I had this fear of judgment. And one thing I like to say is, because people say, I don't care what people think. Now I do care what people think, because your opinion does matter. So no matter whether you agree with me or you're calling me nasty names, your words do matter. I was stifled. My voice was stifled, especially as a child. Sit down and shut up. Kids are meant to be seen, not heard. And a lot of us are stifled. Voices are stifled. So what this does is it makes it so we don't share our thoughts and ideas to people, because we're told not to. And so the one thing I like to say is that your thoughts of me do matter to me. But here's my caveat. Is I myself will not allow them to adversely affect my life. So there's a difference. This is saying your words matter, but I am not going to let them adversely penetrate me like I did for so many decades. So what that does is that gives me power to say, you can say anything you want. And I got a great example of that. I was in a clubhouse room the other day, and there was a question that was being asked. And so every person on the stage was being told to, go ahead and share with us what's your thought. Do you believe in this, yes or no? And then tell us why. So I said, yes, 100%, I believe in this. I don't remember what the question was. And I went on to tell why I believed in it. The next woman who came up, she goes, I must say that I 100% disagree with every single thing Linda just shared. And that would have crushed me before I faced those fears every day. But this particular day, she said all these words. I had zero emotional thoughts about it. My body didn't adversely react. In the past, my stomach would have just gone crazy of nerves. And then so when she was done speaking, I said, I'd like to comment on what you just said. And I just want to share with you that years ago, that would have crushed me. But today, it didn't affect me adversely at all. And I believe that your thoughts are valid, because that's what you believe. And I just happen to believe something different. And it was really cool, because then she came back and she said, thank you so much for sharing that, because I was worried about saying something, but I wanted to share my voice. And it was such a beautiful moment for me to realize that I've grown that much, that I didn't let somebody's, opposite opinion of what I had, that I didn't let it adversely affect my life.
I love that. I was getting chills while listening to you. I love that. And that's really the ultimate outcome, is to, however you get there, listening to someone criticize or listening to someone disagree, not letting it affect you is the ultimate outcome.
Yeah. It's powerful.
very powerful. It's very powerful. And so that, because I have questions that I usually ask people, and there's yes or no questions. And can other people hurt your feelings? Can other people offend you? Can other people disappoint you? Do you blame other people for how you feel? Do you blame your circumstances for how you feel? And if you answer yes to any of those, then that means that these outside forces or whoever, people, circumstances, can have the power to move you up or down. And I love that you were saying that. I'm a little different, though, because I'm a little different. I love that you are open enough to listen to other people and have their criticisms. I listen to criticism also, and they definitely don't move me up or down. And I just contribute it to my practice of being really solid in who I am and being okay with who I am and how I think and what I think, and still being open to change and open to new ideas.
Yeah, I think that's important, that being open, yeah.
Yeah, and I also, now I'm going to jump back because I jump all over the place, but I want to go back to this because it's a fascinating story. At 5 years old, you were gone for an entire week. And remembering back, do you know why you left and where did you go and what were the consequences when you came back home?
Great question. Thanks so much. I had the pleasure and privilege of sitting with Les Brown for a couple hours one day, and he asked me those same exact questions. So I love it. And you know, when he asked me, why did you run away? I said, I was tired of it. I was fed up with it. And he said, but wait a minute. That's not the case, because you had experienced that for 5 years. What was different on that day, that one day that you said, I'm out of here, you know? And I was like, wow, that's such a great question. And really what was different was that I finally stood up for myself. I had allowed the abuse that had been happening. My dad was a very volatile, abusive alcoholic, and I had allowed that abuse to penetrate and to affect my life. And that day I said, I'm no longer going to put up with this. I'm standing up and I'm running away. And so where I went was just to the neighbor's house. You know, it was a safe place, right? The safe house. And I ran away to the neighbors. And here's what happened, because you asked the question of, you know, how was it when you came back? Well, first I want you to imagine at 5 years old, either you have a child, you know, that was five, or you yourself was five at one point. And imagine running away. And nobody comes to get you. Seven days, nobody comes to get you. So this five-year-old little brain realized or decided at that moment that nobody wants me, nobody loves me, they didn't even come to get me. So as I look back at that, I wish my mom were alive so I could ask her this question, but I can't ask her the question. So I have just made up my own decision of what happened in that moment, that you know, my mom knew I was gone. I knew this because she told me later that she knew I was gone. And I didn't pry into it. And here's the thing is, I imagine that my mom was allowing me to exercise my individuality. But here's this five-year-old, they don't love me. They don't want me around. So it's kind of interesting how, you know, that 1 week in my life was extremely pivotal in my life to go forward, because I saw things different about my family. I saw that they didn't want me, right? And when they would be laughing, I thought they were laughing at me. When they would make fun of my nose, I was like, I was ostracized. And so how I felt in that family was different. I felt like I didn't belong. And I know that it stemmed from that 1 week of being gone and nobody coming to get me.
Wow. You know, you are reminding me. And by the way, the people that are in the queue, if you want to ask questions, just press the number one. That reminds me of a story. I have one even younger. I remember I was in a crib. I know I could stand up, though, because I remember standing up in my crib. It was in the middle of the night. I must have had a nightmare because I woke up and I woke up crying. And my crib was right next to a light switch. And I remember standing up, holding the light switch, turning it on and off, all while I'm screaming. You know, like you said, hey, I'm hurt, I'm scared, whatever it was. I was thinking that turning the light switch on and off was making a noise. I remember thinking that, and I kept turning it on and off and on and off for minutes and minutes, and then finally, of course, I was exhausted. And that was my first time really feeling that sense of abandonment, nobody caring. But I look back on it. I mean, my father was one of those old-fashioned guys, and, you know, when a kid is crying, you just let them cry. But all of that stuff was internalized. I'll never forget that incident. And, in fact, when I was older, this may be about 10 years ago, I went back to that house. And there's that light switch. Of course, there's no crib. There's that light switch that I was clicking on and off, thinking that it was making a noise. But I definitely remember at that moment not feeling valued, not feeling protected, all of those things. And that was the beginning for me.
Wow, to remember that far back, that's just incredible. You know, one thing I like to share is that, I mean, imagine, like you mentioned, you know, everybody is different, as different as our fingerprints. And, you know, imagine you have twins and let's say you're either a single mother or you're married and your husband's gone somewhere doing something and both kids start crying. Well, as a mother, who are you going to pick up? You're going to pick up the child who's crying the loudest, right? The one that's creating the most insaneness, right? And you're going to calm that one down and then you're going to take care of the other kid. Now imagine those kids, they're sitting there and the second kid is saying, she must love her or him more because she takes care of him or her first every time. So there's this hierarchy that's created even at such a very young age because just like you said, you were crying, nobody came to get you. So there's something that happened that in your brain you decided what that meant.
Yeah, I could feel what that meant, yes. And I even have a younger memory, but it's nothing traumatic like that. You know, I remember being photographed on this glass table, and I was outside, and my mother took a lot of pictures of me with this Afghan, a lot of photographs. And I remember looking down at the ground. I said, "Oh, we could see through this table." Now I was a little baby, but I do have a few really vivid memories of childhood and. It's fascinating to go back and to dissect or even not analyze, but just do some really deep digging as to why and the makeup. I think that introspection is really important, and honest introspection is really important, especially when you're ready to grow and let go of all of the stuff that is really holding you. In a certain spot. I'm not going to say holding back, but holding you in the same place.
Yeah, interesting,
you,
you know, that you remember that far back. Cause, I share the 5-year-old story. This is a story my mom told me. Like, I don't remember it. I don't actually remember that because I don't remember any of my childhood up to about age 12. And that's because
you mean you didn't remember that. No, you didn't remember that you ran away?
No. Yeah, I blocked out my first about 12 years of my life, especially inside of that household. You know, it was such a traumatic life for me. I believe that's why I blocked it out. And I've gone through hypnosis. I've gone through, you name it. I have tried so many different ways to be able to bring that back. But I don't know if it's necessary really for me because I've made so much tremendous growth without remembering it. But it's my mom, she used to share the story all the time about how I ran away at 5, and so I imagined that was that pivotal moment in my life that made me decide that nobody loves me, nobody wants me around.
Wow. Now, did your father spank you?
My mom was more like the disciplinarian, and I think it was because she didn't want my dad to discipline. You know, yeah. She had a paddle. at that, and all sometimes all she had to do was stare at the paddle, and you're like, okay, I better stop, you know. I was very compliant. I was a compliant child because I didn't really want to I didn't want to get hurt. Now, you know, some of my siblings did, but I was very compliant, and that's, you know, what happened was, again, I shut my mouth, and I stayed in a corner. I was not seen. I was not heard. And, you know, I really didn't want to ruffle any feathers. It was due to the tremendous amount of fear that I had.
Well, that, yeah. Well, I was spanked, and I believe that it's very traumatic to, you know, a child. This is coming from me, a child that looks at their parents, you know, love them, and then all of a sudden you're getting spanked and beaten. And my last spanking was, yeah, I was 17 years old. Talk about being compliant. Yeah, I relate,
wow,
to all of that, just very quiet, very compliant. I mean, spanking, and then I look back on it, my father was just raised in a way that fear was very important in raising a child, using fear. And I remember never, ever, ever wanting my son to be afraid of me. But that is how you can control, in my family, that's how I was controlled, by fear. Fear of another spanking, fear of, you know, fear of not bringing an A home. All of the fear, and it was, and I really am one of those people that know the only reason why you can hit a child is because you can get away with it. You know, all of us adults make mistakes, but we don't get hit because of it. So I'm a real big advocate of that. But that use of fear, I mean, that physical beating and causing the fear, I mean, yeah, it's fear is a really good way to control a child. I don't know how we got on that. Let's
adults,
see.
Adults too. Well, you know, I wanted to just briefly touch on that because I myself, as a parent, I emulated what I grew up in. And I did spank my children. I didn't spank them a lot, but I did spank my children. And, you know, the good old saying, this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you. I don't know if that's true or not, you know. But I used to regurgitate all that crap I heard, you know. I regurgitated it. And, you know, I talk to my kids now, and they're like, you know what, Mom, we love you. And we know you did what you, you know, the best you could with the tools you had. And I'm so grateful to them for that, because I felt like I ruined their life because I was definitely not the best mother, you know.
Please let me stand in line in front of you because I'm a little bit older. Yeah, I also always thought if I could only go back and do it one more time. But I remember the first time I don't remember what he did, but I smacked him on his leg, and I think it was maybe 3 years old, and I smacked him really hard, and he looked at me with so much fear in his eyes, and I said, never again, never again. So, you know, there were other things as far as grounding, no TV, that kind of thing that I implemented, but he was one of those good kids. But yeah, that guilt feeling, no, I stopped that right away, because I knew that for me, that spanking just broke, and it didn't take, and it took me until I was older to, and I mean older, in my 20s, to be able to let all of that crap go. Yeah, it was, yeah, that fear, having children being afraid of you, at least I'm just talking about my family. It was really an eye-opener for me. I did not want to do what my parents did to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. That's good. Good for you.
Now, did we get so we said the consequences coming back. So you said that you don't remember your child, or you blocked all that out until 12. And you sound just like me going through the hypnosis and all of that digging and searching and searching and seeking and wanting to find answers, wanting to find the truth, and to find the truth to just be more at peace with yourself.
Yeah, and that's something I did last year was was so helpful for me. And because I'm always looking at how can I be a better person today than I was yesterday. Now, does it always happen? No, but I still strive for that, right? That's my striving for being a better person today than yesterday. And so something was interesting that happened the last 100 days of last year is my husband and I went to the local pier we have here. I'm in San Diego, California. And as I was there, I walked down the pier and he just hung out. My husband stayed behind. And I flashed on my childhood of, I was probably about 13 or 14 when we would go to that pier and, you know, fish. My dad loved to fish, so he would take us fishing. And I hated it. Everything my dad loved, I hated, you know, just because I just hated my dad so much. And I wouldn't see beauty in anything. You know, I wouldn't see beauty in anything that he loved because I hated him so much, you know. But so we would go fishing, and I was walking down there remembering how I hated fishing. And I said, you know what, that for the last however many days there are left in this year, it just happened to be 100, I'm going to tell the story to myself of what happened, and then I'm going to tell a different story. So what I did the last 100 days is I ended up not only forgiving my dad, but also having gratitude for my dad for all the lessons I learned with my life with him. So, for example, I would walk down that pier and I would say, okay, here's the story I remember. And the story was that I hated going fishing. We would sit there. I was miserable. I could see pictures with my face that you could see how absolutely miserable I was. And then I would turn it around and I would say, oh, my God, I loved going fishing with my dad because that was one of the ways that he could connect with me. That was his way of showing me that he loved me because he was inviting me to a place that he really enjoyed. So I flipped my story. I have changed my story based on wanting to create a better memory of my dad. And so what happened is by the end of last year, I had not only completely forgiven him, but I have gratitude for my dad. I no longer see him as the monster I saw him as. I see him as a human being and with compassion, understanding, and just appreciative that he gave me the life he did and taught me all that he taught me. It's a complete flip of how I saw him before.
So now what you're doing is talking about what I share is the ability to change a perspective. And I even challenge myself and others to practice telling the story, because the story is all, you know, that story is so ingrained, but practice telling the same story five different ways. So you can tell a sad story with a happy ending. My ego, I'm going to just speak for myself, my ego is only limited to one perspective. But in reality, you can practice, just like what you explained, telling the same story or telling a different story to have a different ending. And we all have that power. When I talk about one of the things that when I teach the importance of happiness classes, I give everyone, at the beginning of class, I give everyone a gift. It's in a little package, and I say, in this package is the answer to all of your challenges, all of your problems for the rest of your life. So what's in the package? And the answer is a mirror. You just described how powerful we all are. We can change our perspective. We can have a different ending if you want to. If you are motivated enough to, and you are one motivated young lady. That's what I have to say. And so the motivation, so what is the motivation? Is your motivation powerful enough for you to make a change, powerful enough for you to take action in a different way? And it all comes back to that person in the mirror.
Yeah, it really does. And I love that. It's we're powerful beyond belief, and sometimes it's scary how powerful we are, and you know, how often are we tapping into that because of the fears that we have. So I have decided for decades. Well, first of all, thanks for calling me a young lady. That was awesome. But I decided for decades I wanted to hate my dad. That was my decision. And so it was through that exercise of deciding, you know, we make a decision and then we do something, right? So it was that exercise of deciding to forgive him. First I said, I'm going to forgive him. And then I said, wait a minute, I want to go beyond just forgiveness. I want to have gratitude and be, you know, just so thankful that he gave me so much. And I want to turn my perspective of my dad, because there were people in his life who absolutely loved him and adored him. And I was so, my blinders were up so strong. Like, it was like having steel blinders in front of me, that there was no way I was ever going to see what those people saw in my dad. But then I decided I was going to do that, you know? And it completely, like I said, it completely changed my perspective, as well as it changed who I am. And now I can show up more, having more compassion and understanding for people. You know, it's completely changed who I am.
Well, that compassion for someone, and it's, you know, having this lack of forgiveness, or because I believe that everything happens, and there really aren't any mistakes. There is, everything is in order, and so, like you said, what happened to you brought you to who you are today. And now I lost my train of thought. I knew that was going to happen. And it was so, so good when I was thinking, let me just take a couple of deep breaths. Passion. Making the decision. Whenever you hate, not just you, but if you hate or you can't forgive, you might as well just drink poison, because you are the one poisoning self. This lack of compassion or hate for others, or pointing the finger and having these horrible thoughts about someone else, it's really about self. It's really about self.
Yeah.
So you're shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah, and I'll share a great story of that relates to that. Is my dad was an alcoholic. When I was 16, he got arrested, his third time. So they called it, you know, three strikes, you're out. And he got his driver's license taken away from him. And he moved away from us for a year because he had to work. He had to live close to work. And during that year, I remember my mom, sometimes she would say, okay, let's go visit your dad. And I was like, do we have to? Why do we have to go see him? I don't want to see him ever, you know. And so we went and visited him, and I just had a horrible time. But it was there was, during this journey, one of the things he had to do is start AA. That was one of the things the judge reminded him, that he had to go to AA. And I remember that when he got to, I don't know the steps or anything, because I'd never got involved in it, but there, one of the steps is to, something about going to those that you've hurt and apologizing or something along that lines. I don't know exactly what it is, but I remember my dad coming to me and doing that step and telling me what it was all about and asking for my forgiveness or something like that, whatever it was. And I didn't forgive him at all. And then he walked away, and he ended up going and asking for forgiveness from all the people. And then he went through all of the steps, all 12 steps, and he was done, you know, going through the steps. But he stayed in AA for 40 years. Now, it wasn't until after he passed away. Now, what I used to say is that my dad is such a hypocrite. He didn't go through all those steps. You know, I never forgave him. This was a 16-year-old kid, because I thought that step was about us all forgiving him. What I didn't realize is that step was about him stepping up and asking for forgiveness. And that was all it was about. It was for him to take that step to say, I've done something, I shouldn't have done it, I wish I hadn't, whatever it was, you know. And for him to take the step. The step had nothing to do with me. So I thought for all those decades, he was in AA 40 years, I thought he was a hypocrite, because he never finished that step, because I never forgave him. So it's really interesting, because like you're saying, like holding up the mirror, he was holding up the mirror. I wasn't. He was. He was holding up the mirror and saying, I'm where I am. I don't like who I am. I want to change, and I'm doing what I can to change. But I never saw it that way until after he was dead.
Wow. Now, I have a really hard, well, I don't know if it's a hard question. I have a question for you because I have the have the same, you know, mother, father thing. Were you ever angry or blamed your mother for staying with a man who mistreated you?
Yes. I remember saying things like, my mom is so weak. How can she stay with him? And I was always mad at her when we ran away, because one time, I think I was probably about 9 or 10 years old, when she packed up all of us kids, there's 5 of us, and I'm number 4, she packed up all of us kids and took us to the bank to take all the money out, and we were running away. Finally, we're going to get away from him. So what she did is, because we had 2 dogs, so it was 5 kids, 2 dogs, my mom, in our paneled station wagon back in the 70s, you know, and she went into the bank, and she said, whatever you do, if he shows up, do not let him in into the car. And my dad showed up, and my brother opened the door, and we all got out of the car. There we were with my dad when my mom came out of the bank. And so my brother, he was probably scared and opened that door, but, you know, we didn't do what mom told us to do, and so we got back in the car and drove right back home. And so that was one of those instances. And then even later in life, when, you know, I was married, had my kids, my husband, I owned a home, and mom came to my house and said, can I stay here? Can I live with you guys? Because I'm leaving him. It's done. I'm fine. All of us kids were moved out of the house. So she didn't have the kids as her reason for staying anymore. And what I found out is she went to all 5 kids' houses, asked all 5 kids if she could stay with them, and then she went back home. And I always looked at her as weak for that. And I was talking to my life coach, blaming my mom, and she said, what if you looked at it differently? What if you looked at how strong she was for putting up with that? What if you looked at how strong she was for keeping the family together? Because the family stayed together because of my mom. And, again, it gave me a different perspective of my mom. But I did. I had so much blame, you know, for her, for all of those instances of us staying with him, of her putting up with that, of her taking his abuse. Even the last words that he said when she passed away, it was something condescending. I'm sorry. The last words he said when he was passing away was condescending to my mom, and it was just the way he was. And then I was standing right next to my mom. My dad took his very last breath. He was pronounced dead. And my mom said, thank God the bastard is dead. Those were her first words when my dad took his last breath. She was finally free of him after 55 years.
Well, I can, my whole thing, I'm a real advocate for children, and I think my one perspective is that mothers are supposed to protect their children. And one of the most, I think it's a harrowing story, is when my father was a spanker and something happened. My brother, he was in the 5th grade. Now, this is way back in, what, the 70s, early 70s? No, maybe 60s, in the 5th grade. And he threw a ball, and it hit the teacher. So hold on, let me just adjust this just for a second. UST, I was bounced out of this. And my father, and you can't do that today, my father went to the school and spanked my brother in front of the class, in front of the teacher, up and down the aisle with a belt. And I talked about, I blamed my mother. I blamed her. I thought my mother was weak, the same thing. How could you not protect your children? But it always goes back to her parents, and she wasn't protected. And my mother would only complain about my father, and I, well, leave. And then finally, I don't remember when it was, but years later, I said, they're doing a dance together. She wouldn't want to, she's not going to leave him. She feels that this is how she's supposed to be treated. She she was comfortable with being treated so poorly. And I had to really let go of, number one, being in their business and not blaming her or blaming him for the dance they both did. He never left her. She never left him. And then the funny part is when he was diagnosed, it's called hydrocephalitis, and it parallels Alzheimer's. So when he was diagnosed, boy, oh boy, did she take out, she took out a lot of stuff on him. She was mean. She was short. She was mean to him, and he was mentally disabled. And I said, oh, she's getting her licks in before he goes. And it's just, it's an interesting life for me, being an outsider, that's not my relationship, and what worked for them would work for her and him. It was a dance that they both did. I wouldn't want that dance, but I accept that that's what they did together.
Yeah. Well, I want to share something, because I meant the last thing I said was, thank God the bastard is dead. It was my mom's words.
Mm-hmm.
So my mom lived 3 years, for three more years after my dad passed away. And unfortunately, she didn't get to do all the things she wanted to do in life, because now she was older and her health was failing her. And 2 weeks before she passed away, she looked at me and said, I spent so many years living my life with regrets. You go out there and live the rest of your life with no regrets. And that was such a great thing that she did for me, because that's really I didn't start my personal development journey at that time, but once I started it, I realized how powerful those words were for me. So that's what I do, live every single day to the best of my ability, become better today than I was yesterday. That's my goal. And then to live my life with no regrets. So when I get to the end, I don't say the same words as my mom did. You know what I mean? It's so, so powerful. And I no longer see my mom as weak. My life coach helped me with that, because just those words of, what if you saw the strength that she had to stay with that, to endure through that? That was her choice.
Yes.
That was her life. But she was strong, she was so strong. She kept us all together. She kept a family of, none of us kids got into drugs. None of us were ever in and out of jail, which, a lot of people who grew up in those kinds of families do have that. It was my mom's strength that kept us to be who we are. It really was her strength.
I love that. That is a powerful story. And I totally agree with this, the labeling of weak. The focusing on something weak, and who's to say what's weak and who's to say what's not weak. But when you talk about the regrets, there is a very famous study that was done by a hospice nurse. Her name is Bronnie Ware, I believe. I don't know if I shared that with you or not. But anyway, the five most regrets of the dying. So she interviewed these people that had a week to live, 2 weeks to live, 3 months to live, 6 months to live. And what are the five most regrets of the dying? The first one is, I wish I would have pursued my dreams and aspirations and not the life others expected of me. The second one is, I wish I didn't work so hard. I wish I had the courage to express my feelings and speak my mind. I wish I had stayed in touch with my friends. And then the last one is, I wish I would have let myself be happier. So I love this, because you can't get any more real and more true than people that are dying and looking back and reflecting on their life. Who better to ask? I remember I used to volunteer at the senior center. And then I asked this woman, I said, well, what do you want? I mean, what do you wish that would happen? I mean, she was in her 80s. And she says, I just wish I had a car so I could visit my daughter more often. I think she was an hour and a half away from her daughter. So when you really get down to it, at least for me, it's the things that are intangible and the things that really bring you some type of peace, inner peace, regardless. And my inner peace is different than yours. But finding that peace, finding that contentment, finding that vibration of satisfaction and finding satisfaction in the moment, in every moment in your life, in the mirror. I can't believe the hour is almost up. This is crazy.
I know. Well, yeah, one thing I want to share that has been such a beautiful experience for me is my relationship with my daughter. I had a strained relationship with her so many years. You know, the mother-daughter conflict was real in my house, you know. And as she got older and became more combative, you know, as she got older, and there would be things that she would roll her eyes at me and say mean things to me and stuff. And then I started my personal development journey at age 51. So I was 51 when I started. And I started becoming better and learning how to communicate with her better. And what I found is the more I started learning to communicate with her better, the more she started communicating with me better. Now, this has been 7 years, you know, 7 years of this journey. Last night, I was 6 hours from home, so I was on this long road for 6 hours by myself, and my daughter called me, which she doesn't call that often, but, you know, she called me, and we ended up chatting for an hour. This is something, a relationship I didn't have with my mom, and I'm so grateful to have that relationship with my daughter, a strained relationship for so many years with her, that now she's age 37, and we're moving to that place where, you know, she actually likes to have conversations with me, and I love talking to her, and I'm so just grateful to her for, you know, accepting me for who I am and who I'm becoming, you know, because I'm still growing, and I'm going to continue to grow until the time I take that last breath. That is my mission, you know, my mission for myself.
Well, I talk about the only reason that I have problems with any relationship, in any relationship, is because I don't accept them for who they are. And my definition of love is loving unconditionally and acceptance. But the key is you started changing. You made the change. And what happens is when you make the change, people around you can't do anything but get on board. Now or later,
well,
but it really
not,
started
not
with
necessarily.
You.
Yeah, I'm gonna rebut that because my family, my sisters haven't. They don't like what I'm doing. They don't. They actually confronted me one day. They did like an intervention. Like, there's something wrong. You know, the people you're hanging out with, they're bad people. They don't have your best interest at heart. And we believe you're in a cult. And these were positive people. These are people who are actually, like, the people I hang out with are people who are actually really changing the world. And so when they said that, I was like, you know what? I can't be around you guys. Because what they said at that time, it did penetrate. It did adversely affect me. And I said, I can't be around you guys because I need to build a strong foundation so that when anybody says anything that is mean toward me, that it no longer adversely affects my life. And when I'm done with that, building that foundation, then I'll reach back out to you guys and I'll see if you're interested in, you know, having me in your life. So they did not change at all. They wanted me to change back to who I used to be. And I said, I am never going to be that person again. Never. I was miserable. Why would I want to be that?
Well, I understand exactly what you're saying, and you're right. What you're doing is growing enough. I always say, is an elephant bothered by a gnat? And so the more you grow and the more you are who you are, then no one can affect you. However, it's admirable that you can look at it and make your, and in other words, not, I don't want to say protect yourself, but be so sure of yourself that no one else can say or do anything. And you choose who you want to spend a lot of time with. I get that totally. You know,
yeah.
We're at the end of the show. I cannot believe this. Will you let people know, it's already in the bio, but let people know how they can contact you.
Yes, thank you so much, Rebecca, for having me, and I've enjoyed the conversation. I can't believe that hour flew by, that's for sure. They can find me, or email me is the best way. Email Lynda, L-Y-N-D-A, @womenactiontakers.com. I'm also on all the social medias as Linda Sunshine West. And then my website is womenactiontakers.com.
I love it. I love it. Thank you so much, Linda. And that's the end of today's show. I want everyone to thank you for listening. Reality Spirituality is heard every Sunday at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. My website is RebeccaNorrington.com. Follow me on Twitter at RL Norrington and LinkedIn. I have an Instagram handle, Reality Spirituality. My first book, Reality Spirituality, The Truth About Happiness, can be purchased on Amazon. And my second book is What I'm Working On Now. And until next week, my audience, I would like you to remember who you are. You're a physical extension of the universe. You're always evolving. You're always changing. You're always growing. Love is patience, and love is kind. Be patient and be kind to yourself. Be your own best friend. And remember, you cannot have a happy ending to an unhappy journey. You've been listening to Reality Spirituality with yours truly. And remember, happiness is a practice skill. We'll talk to you again next week. Have a conscious week.
Yeah. Oh, it's time to get real. Oh, yeah.
Spirituality.
It's a new experiment.
Spirituality.
Yeah, keep your ears open for this one,
man. Spirituality.
You got a question for RL? Time to get some answers, baby. Oh, now we get real.
Get real good.
Get real good.
Get real good.
That's what I'm about to say.
Time to get